Now joining us on Book Corner, very special guest with a rather interesting subject. When I picked this book up, I didn't know what to expect, but Howard soon brought it to life. It's called The 27 Club, The History of The 27 Club. And on the cover, you'll see a picture of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and the newest addition, Amy Winehouse. And Howard Soons now joins us. And Howard, first of all, congratulations to you on the book and interesting subject matter.
Yeah, it's a macabre subject, but death is a good subject to write about.
It is, and in particular these folks. There's been a lot of interest in all the names I mentioned. What is it about these people who leave us early and they leave behind tremendous legends?
Two things. I mean, in the first instance, they were all significant artists. So whether they died at 27 or not, they were still significant artists. They all did good work. And if you listen to the music of these six principal 27s, it's a fantastic listen. The Doors, Jimi Hendrix, no greater guitarist than Jimi Hendrix. Janis Joplin was a wonderful singer. Jim Morrison was a wonderfully theatrical frontman. You know, the Nirvana were good. Amy Winehouse was wonderful. Brian Jones founded the Rolling Stones. They're all big names. And then comes the coincidence that they all happen to die at the same age. And what this book does is unpack that. What is it about them that made them die young? What does the 27 Club mean? Is it anything more than a coincidence? All those things. And who else died at 27? And is it at all unusual to die at 27 in the rock and roll business? These are all interesting subjects.
You have a way of getting into the biography of these folks, digging deep, going beneath the surface, getting beyond what's been presented to us by the media. Most of them have something in common. A lot of these people are really sensitive souls, aren't they, that we're dealing with here?
Well, yeah, and a bit more than that, I would say. I would say they all had what psychiatrists call behavioral disorders, really, bordering on mental health issues. These are all very neurotic people, highly sensitive people, bordering on neurotic people, whose behavior isn't normal. And in fact, the reason they all died young, the reason Brian Jones died young, whereas his bandmates lived on to old age, is that Brian just wasn't able mentally to cope with the pressures of fame and success. He crumpled. He was intrinsically a weak personality. And that's true of all of them, if you study them. They were not strong people mentally.
Howard Soons is our guest. And by the way, his name is spelled S-O-U-N-E-S. You can check him out at howardsoons.com. And Howard, you've come from a background where you have written tremendous biographies, I know, on a wide range of folks. And I know you wrote something on Bob Dylan that was excellent, and Paul McCartney as well, that was really well received. How much of a challenge was it for you to try and touch on these folks and yet not go too deep? I'm sure you left a lot of things on the cutting room floor for this.
My books are based on a great deal of original research. I guess that's what I'm known for, if anything. And what I try to do is get beyond the image of famous people, which is often just PR puff. It doesn't really mean very much. There's a lot of image in the rock and roll business in particular, and to sort of find out what these people are really like, for good and for bad. And so in my biographies of Bob Dylan and Paul McCartney, we see the man behind the image, hopefully. With these 27s, I guess the challenge was that it's a book about six people in one book rather than a biography of one person. My original interest was in Amy Winehouse. Her death really sparked my interest in the whole subject. And when Amy died here in London, I was a great admirer of her work. I thought she was a tremendous artist, great songwriter as well as a great performer. When she died, the press coverage was along the lines of another rock and roller joins the 27 Club. There were headlines invoking phrases like the curse of 27 strikes again. And I was intrigued by this because, of course, I realized there was no such thing as a curse. This was nonsense, just loose talk. But it was interesting that she died at the same age as, you know, many great artists before her. And it seemed to me to be worthy of investigation, deep investigation, in fact, to find out why they all died. And that's important because there's a great deal of mythology about the deaths of these people. A lot of it is simply untrue. It's make-believe, it's wishful thinking by fans, or it's deliberate deceit by the people who were around them when they died to obfuscate the truth about why they died. And I thought it was worthwhile finding out how they really died, what really happened to them, and to compare their lives and deaths and see if there were any common themes that explain why all these people died young. And indeed, that is the case. There are reasons why they all died young, which they have in common.
These are incredibly self-destructive people, aren't they?
Yeah, they are basically people who killed themselves, if you really look at it closely. Kurt Cobain is the only person who's got suicide stamped on his death certificate. But if you abuse, drink, or drugs, in spite of all the warnings from doctors and friends and everybody else, if you continue to abuse, drink, and drugs for years, something bad's going to happen to you. There's a kind of self-destructive death wish going on with all of these six. And then if you look at the longer list of people who died at 27, I've got a list of 50 in the book, the long list. They're not all as well known as the big six, but you'll find a large proportion of them had this really self-destructive streak. Some of them died by accident. Some of them died of natural causes. But there's a very large proportion of them who died through the abuse of drink and drugs, which they abused with a recklessness bordering on self-destruction. And there are some straightforward suicides as well.
You know, your list of 50 stopped me in my tracks because we're only conditioned through our popular culture around the world to, and now the internet sort of unites us, but we're only conditioned to think about the big ones. How did you do the research to come up with the other folks, the 50 that are on that list at the age of 27?
Well, I realized that, first of all, that I'd had to give the readers a pretty definitive idea of how many people had died at 27 in the music business. Because the first thing to answer, the first question readers want to know is, how unusual is it statistically to die at 27? Is it at all unusual if you're a rock and roll star to die at 27? And so in order to answer that question, I did a survey of about 3,000 people who died over a period of 100 years, who were well-known enough in the music business to get obituaries in the newspapers or something like that. And I simply did a chart of what ages they died at and their cause of death. And out of these 3,000 people, I then plotted a graph, which is on about page 20 of the book. And you'll see on the graph that 50 people in total die at 27. Now, that is by far, that is not at all the highest number. You're far more likely, it turns out, to die in middle age if you're a rock and roll star. The peak is in the 60s somewhere. But in the very early part of the graph, where people are quite young, in their 20s, there is a spike at 27, which surprised me, in fact.
Yeah, it's shocking to me. And again, as I got into this book, I thought, you know, this is not going to last long. This is morbid. Howard, I'm the type of guy who usually likes comedies. I do not like dramas. I do not like things that invade in real life. There's enough real life in real life, if you know what I mean. But that said, the spike is really telling. The chart falls on page 13 in your book. And at the age of 27... there are 30 deaths that occurred in the subgroup of people you look at. And at the age of 29, there are 30, it looks like there are 31 or 32 deaths. But the age of 27, the number spikes to 50, and it's not even close. So that is a startling spike there.
There are a few reasons for that. I mean, one is that if you get into rock and roll and you're successful, you probably start around about the age of 21, 22, which is the case of all these, the big six. And if you are recklessly abusing drink and drugs, there's a kind of certain number of years it takes to just wear yourself out. So that's one reason. The other reason is that it just so happened there were these very big names who died at that age in the 60s, within months of each other. Brian Jones, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix. And that created this phenomenon in the public consciousness. And so whenever somebody dies at 27 in rock and roll, they're immediately identified, and that tends to bulk the numbers out because, to some extent, it's a subjective process of who is included in the club because who does one consider to be well-known enough to be included in the club? Some of them are quite obscure. So that, I think, distorts the figure slightly, but nevertheless, there is this spike. Now, but this spike, there is nothing supernatural about this spike. There's nothing dangerous about the number 27 per se. what we find is if we look at these 50 deaths, well, quite a few of them die as young people often do in car crashes, motorbike crashes. Some of them die, freak accidents. One guy falls off a horse, a couple of plane crashes. Some people die of natural causes. But there is a very high proportion of drink and drug-related death. And in Kurt Cobain's case, that's also a form of suicide because he deliberately took an overdose to kill himself. And that gets to the reason why these people are dying young, that they are abusing themselves recklessly and self-destructively. And then you have to ask yourself, well, why are they doing that? That's part of the book. And in the first half of the book, is really a study of the young lives of these people. And we find that they come from very often highly dysfunctional family backgrounds. The family story is often a complete mess. And that's the start of problems which develop before they ever become famous. And then when they become famous, well, that's just another problem because fame doesn't make them happy. It just brings more problems into their lives. And also we find that many of them hook up and surround themselves with equally self-destructive, unreliable, dangerous people. Often they marry people who have drug problems. Look at Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, and look at Amy Winehouse and her husband Blake Field of Civil. So they have a drug problem, they marry someone with a drug problem. Well, this is not a recipe for a happy or successful or long life.
I want to go back. You were talking before about myths. And there's a certain cottage industry around these people. The Jim Morrison that we see in the iconic photo, the cheesecake Jim Morrison. There are teenage kids that you see now that will wear that. He's sort of become an icon through the years, and it's a hip thing to have Jim Morrison on. But there are myths around him. There are myths around all these people. If you could, your book does dispel some myths. Let's start with Jim Morrison. What were some of the myths you feel like you were able to dispel through your research on Jim Morrison?
Well, there is so much nonsense spoken about the death of Jim Morrison. People think that he's not really dead, for a start, which is preposterous. People think he was somehow murdered, or that he simply died of a natural heart attack. But these explanations are propounded by people who haven't looked at the evidence. And if you look at the evidence and you go back to the police files, which I did, I went to Paris. He died in Paris, of course. And if you look at what the people who were actually there said at the time, it is completely clear that the guy was using heroin, that he overdosed. He was with a woman, his girlfriend, who was also a drug addict. When Jim overdosed, she put him in the bath to revive him, which is a well-known way of reviving somebody who's overdosed. But the method is to put someone in a cold bath and sit with them until they come round. Well, she rather foolishly put him in a hot bath and she left him. And when she came back in the morning, he was dead. Now, this is sadly typical of the 27s in that they have these flaky partners who do stupid and dangerous things. And they themselves do stupid and dangerous things. And so Jim Morrison died in a rather ridiculous way. But if you look at the backstory of Jim Morrison, you find this self-destructive person who is very similar in personality to Amy Winehouse and Janis Joplin and the others, self-destructive with a kind of death wish. But the death is clearly drug-related. The problem is that the girlfriend, Pamela Courson, then lied to the police, the French police, because she was terrified they would discover she was a drug addict and kick her out of the country or arrest her. And as a result, there has been years and years of mythologizing about what really happened to Jim Morrison. And often fans don't really want to know the truth. They would rather have this romantic mystery, which is nothing to do with the truth. It's a kind of idea they have in their head of who Jim Morrison really was. It's a fantasy. And unfortunately, that is the mentality of fans of all celebrities. And they don't really want to face the facts. What I've tried to do with this book is actually show people the facts. If you really want to look at the facts, this is where the facts are. None of the nonsense you'll see in books about Jim Morrison still being alive and living in South America, this is just complete make-believe.
And it makes us feel great to believe that he could still be alive. And I remember as a child back in the late 70s, early 80s, and the Doors had that resurgence there, and they've always sold a lot of records, but there was a peak there when they really got really hot again, especially in the States. And there's always been this whisper, you know, he's still alive. He's living.
Well, yeah, it's already started with a book called No One Gets Out of Here Alive, which rather mischievously teased the readers at the end, maybe Jim's still alive. And the book came out around the time that Apocalypse Now came out, and Apocalypse Now used the end, the Great Door song, the end, over the titles. And Apocalypse Now was a tremendously powerful film in 1979. And Apocalypse Now plus that book, that very powerful book, No One Gets Out of Here Alive, sort of rekindled interest in Jim Morrison and the Doors. And it's been going ever since. It's become mythology. And it is indeed very interesting that as one goes around the world, one sees people with the T-shirts on, mm-hmm. with Jim Morrison with his shirt off and his arms like Christ, mm-hmm. this sort of very good-looking young man. But the Jim Morrison who died in Paris was not that person. The Jim Morrison who died in Paris was a depressed, fat, alcoholic with a drug problem, whose career was at that point pretty much washed up. You know, he'd left the band. He'd walked away from rock and roll. Now, posthumously, the Doors are a very, very big deal. But at the point where Jim Morrison walked away from the band, they were kind of in decline. It just so happened that their last album, L.A. Woman, was a great album and did very, very well. But when Jim Morrison walked away from the band, that wasn't certain.
You know, there's a lot of money in keeping the myth alive, as you pointed out. Jimi Hendrix is another one. I found your stuff on him. I've read an awful lot about Hendrix, but you poke a hole through some of the mythology around him as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, Jimi Hendrix is another example where the woman he was with when he died simply lied. She lied because she was a drug user. He was a drug user. The police were involved. He died here in London, and she's now dead. And she just didn't tell the truth. And as a result, there's been years and years of nonsense about Jimi Hendrix. And as you say, one of the interesting things that emerges in this book, 27, is that after these people die, there are other people, often family members, not always, sometimes, who do very, very well indeed out of the huge amounts of money that are generated posthumously by the estate. And the Jimi Hendrix estate is a particularly unsavory story, which has been very well documented by others, not only by myself, whereby there has been years and years of fighting between people, producers, family members, managers, record companies, fighting over the dollars Jimi Hendrix still generates today, because people are still buying Jimi Hendrix's stuff today, have been for years and years and years. And really, that's a rather sad and tawdry story.
It really is. And in fact, you point out, is it his stepsister? She goes by the name Hendrix. She would have you believe, if you listen to her, because I've heard her on interviews, they have this Experience Hendrix where they have folks go around the country. I mean, they figured out more ways to monetize Jimi Hendrix. And hey, good for them. You know, we live in a capitalistic society. Good for them. As somebody who's a Hendrix fan, they've put more stuff out on him and repackaged him in so many different ways that it's really sort of off-putting.
Well, yes, and then when you go back to the actual lives, you find that in his lifetime, Jimi Hendrix did not have a good relationship with his family. His father was not a good father. And we go back to other stars, Amy Winehouse. Amy Winehouse's father, who has made a career out of being Amy Winehouse's father, he even sings, you know, he even makes CDs. He walked out on the family when Amy was a kid because he wanted to be with a younger woman, i.e. he left Amy's mum. He was a bankrupt when Amy was a kid. And now he runs the Amy Winehouse Foundation. Look at Jim Morrison's family. Jim Morrison absolutely despised his parents, couldn't stand them, wouldn't talk to them. And of course, when he died, millions and millions of dollars flooded the Morrison family. Janis Joplin's siblings, whom she wasn't particularly close to in life, are wealthy to this day. And these stories go on and on and on. And there's a great contrast between the money that's generated afterwards and the kind words that family members and others say about the deceased and the story in reality in life. In life, most of these people had bad relationships with their families. And that was often the start of the problems they had in life.
And this lady, back with the Hendrix thing again, it's just so funny when I'm reading your work, and I'm sorry I don't have her name for this interview we're doing here. Perhaps you can remember it. But she acts like she's the keeper of the flame, and her and Jimmy, they were so close. And she was this little child when he was at the peak of his popularity.
Well, and she refers to herself as Jimmy's sister, whereas in fact, there's no blood relation whatsoever.
Right.
There's money. There's money in these people. Not just Jimi Hendrix. There's money in the estates of all of these people. Big money. In fact, far more money than there was when they were alive. A lot of these people didn't have much money in life. Jim Morrison did not live like a rich man. He lived in shabby apartments. He had hardly anything to his name. I mean, he didn't own anything
that
substantial. But in death, there is huge money being accrued and has been for decades now.
Howard Soons is joining here today on Book Corner. The book is called 27, and it's from DaCapo Press. Again, check this thing out. It is so completely interesting. And I can tell an artist that you're taken by is Amy Winehouse. And the world had a little flavor, a little taste, Howard, of what she could do. And it's such a shame because she's such a throwback artist in an era that's given us so much music that is completely throwaway that no one will listen to 25, 30 years from now. She did some stuff that I do believe will stand the test of time. It's a shame how she destroyed herself.
Yeah, she was a lovable person. She was a very good songwriter, tremendously original songwriter, and a very distinctive performer. She only really made one good album, which was Back to Black, but it is a tremendous album. It's an absolute knockout, five-star modern classic with tracks like Rehab and Me and Mr. Jones on it. It's just a wonderful album. Of course, it's an album all about her own personal unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's expressing her heartbreak principally over her first marriage to Blake Field of Siver, which was a complete disaster. And her life thereafter turned into a kind of tragic comedy, really. I mean, her last few years were just years of drunkenness, missed concerts, court appearances, just, you know, one disaster after another. And unfortunately, I don't think that's done her reputation any good. And of course, she didn't go to America very often. She couldn't go after a while because she had drug convictions and she couldn't get a visa. And as a result, she's not as well known in America as she is here in the UK and in the rest of the world. But she was really a fantastically talented, original young artist, one of the greatest for many, many years. And it's certainly very sad that she destroyed herself as she did. It's a great tragedy.
Yeah, and I could tell that you have a tremendous affinity for her. You did not have to tell me that. I could tell in your writing about her that it hit you, didn't it? I could tell you really enjoyed her music. And what's sad about her and all these people is we'll never know, once they got clean, what kind of art they could have done. And I look at some of the contemporaries from the 60s, for instance, an Eric Clapton, who went on to make some wonderful music once he got clean in the 70s, into the 80s. And there are others. Some perhaps have stayed at the party a little too long. Mick Jagger might come to mind there. But the point still remains that it's a shame that these folks took themselves out of the game as early as they did. And they did take themselves out of the game.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. They could have made the decision to stop drinking, stop using heroin. And they didn't. The result was almost inevitable, actually. So they've got no one to blame, really, but themselves. And then if you had to blame anyone else, you can find other people who weren't helpful in their background stories. But ultimately, they destroyed themselves. And often, you know, strenuous efforts were made to save them. With Amy, she was repeatedly referred to psychologists and psychiatrists, to rehab centers. I mean, her famous song, Rehab, is literally autobiographical. They told me to go to rehab, and I said, no, no, no. I mean, she refused to submit to medical treatment, even when her doctor wrote her a letter saying, if you continue to drink like this, and bear in mind she drank herself to death, if you continue to drink like this, you may die. And yet she drank and drank and drank. And the poor kid, when she was found dead here in London by the police, in her bedroom. She was alone. Often these people die alone. They die lonely deaths. Mm. She was alone in her bedroom with two empty bottles of vodka. So it's a pretty dismal way to end your life. But it's a fascinating subject. You know, death is a fascinating subject. It's something we all have to face in life, something we all share in common. And by studying the lives of these people, you can empathize with them. You can see how they were human beings with frailties like all of us, and they made some very bad decisions, and life went very much out of control. It's actually a fascinating subject, I think, to read about.
I think you did a really terrific job with it. And again, the book is called 27, A History of the 27 Club. And on the way out, Howard, let me ask you this. The term 27 Club, when was it first used? Who coined it? Were you able to come up with that?
Well, I mean, it was made famous. I think it was coined originally by a journalist. It's basically a media construct. But it really became famous, I think, when Kurt Cobain died. And his mother was approached for a comment by a journalist. And his mother said, "He's gone and joined that stupid club, 27 Club. I told him not to." And that quote has echoed through the years. But actually, the phrase predates that by some years. Journalists simply noticed the coincidence of the fact that Brian Jones died in 1969, and he was very, very famous in 1969. Jimi Hendrix died in 1970. Janis Joplin died a few weeks later, the same year, and then Jim Morrison the next year. Well, there are four of the biggest stars of the late 60s dying at the same time, essentially, at the same age. And that's when journalists really pricked up their ears and they invented this phrase, the 27 Club. And then subsequently we've had additions to it, notably Kurt Cobain and Amy Winehouse. But as I say, there's 50.
Yep.
And in fact, there are all sorts of interesting names on the long list. Robert Johnson, the great blues musician, died at 27. I've concentrated on what I would consider to be the six most famous names within rock and roll or modern rock music.
Well, interestingly enough, for the people listening to us in Tennessee, where we record this, of course, you're in London, but Chris Bell, I did not realize if Big Star is a member of the 27 Club. You write that his car hit a telephone pole leaving a rehearsal with Big Star. Chris Bell, who was born in 1951, died in 1978, in December of 78, a couple days after Christmas. And Big Star was a big deal when that crash occurred, Alex Chilton's group, Big Star. So the 27 Club has tentacles that reach around the world. And as you say, tons of names there. Hey, Howard, again, thanks for giving us some time today. And I want to give you a chance to have the final word. So go right ahead, my friend.
Thank you for your interest. And I hope people find the book interesting and informative. And I did my best, as with all books, and it's up to readers to make of it what they will.
Howard Soons, thank you.
Okay, thank you.